Hi, everybody. I am excited to be here to talk a little bit about some of the work that we've done in the program to kind of push the boundaries of environmental health to considering more safe walking environments in San Francisco. And I also have no relationships to disclose. So very briefly, I'm going to give an overview of the problem, talk about some of the targets that San Francisco set for pedestrian safety, how we've been using data and our role as the health department to help achieve the targets, and some of the ongoing initiatives that this work is informed. So briefly, the problem in San Francisco is that really over 2 people a day are hit and injured by a car, and approximately 100 people a year are killed or seriously injured. And pedestrians are really disproportionately account for motor vehicle fatalities. So 50% of people that are killed by cars in San Francisco are people walking. And these rates of pedestrian injury exceed our Healthy People 2020 goals by 5 times. And we also see, similar to areas across the country, that seniors are disproportionately represented in pedestrian injuries. And also that we know this is an underestimate. So based on an analysis that looked at the police reported data versus our hospital data, there's approximately 20% underestimate. So the magnitude of the problem is really significant. And you know, we do a lot of work with our level 1 trauma center at San Francisco General Hospital. And 50% of the people that are seen in their trauma center are either pedestrians or cyclists that are injured on our streets. So it's really difficult to understate the magnitude of the issue. In addition to it, there's really health disparities associated with pedestrian injury. So approximately 50% of injuries occur on only 8% of the surface area in San Francisco. That's the dark blue on this map. These are communities that are much more likely to be lower income neighborhoods with concentrations of seniors, of people with disabilities, of non-English speaking residents, and also of the streets that are our busy arterial streets. So we concentrate vulnerable populations in dangerous streets in the same communities, and we end up with pedestrian injury. So what was a breakthrough for us in San Francisco in 2010 was that our then mayor Gavin Newsom issued a mayoral executive directive that set city targets for injury reductions in San Francisco for serious and fatal injuries of 25% by 2016 and 50% by 2021, in addition to reducing neighborhood inequities and increasing walking. And this directive was really motivated by Vision Zero principles from Sweden, which are really radical, which fundamentally shift the onus of responsibility for pedestrian injury and motor vehicle injury in general from what did the driver do versus what did the person walking do to the design of the system. So instead of asking individuals to behave more safely in a fundamentally dangerous system, Vision Zero really looks at how can we design a system that can be safe for people who are going about their business within that system. The executive directive directed specific short-term actions for 2011, which I'm going to provide a little more nitty-gritty about shortly, and then also directed the development of a citywide pedestrian strategic action plan, which will be released later this year. So this slide illustrates on the left the number of San Francisco agencies that participated in this pedestrian safety task force. We meet monthly in City Hall, which is really important in terms of having the mayor invested in this work. And as you can see, a lot of city agencies fundamentally touch the issue of pedestrian safety, though no one city agency had responsibility for protecting pedestrians, which I think is one reason why we are where we are today. The task force, excitedly, was co-chaired by Rajiv and also one of the deputy directors of our municipal transportation agency. And additionally, the participation of pedestrian safety community organizations was really important. So we had our pedestrian safety advisory committee as well as other community organizations in San Francisco. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the work of the data subcommittee, which I chaired, what we did through 2011. The work of the nitty-gritty really happened in subcommittees in 2011. So our overarching question was really how can data and evidence inform targeting the resources of our city to address this issue. I think it was really important that the data subcommittee was chaired by the Department of Public Health because we're not an implementing agency. So we were able to be more independent agency versus the agencies that are responsible for the infrastructure and, you know, are really tasked with making these investments. One of the first things that we did was move from a multitude of intersections to targeted corridors. And what this really means is that the map on the left represents, I think, what we're often used to seeing in terms of intersections where pedestrian injuries happen. And it fundamentally contributes what you could refer to as a whack-a-mole problem, where you take the top 10 intersections, they account for less than 2% of injuries, you address those intersections, and it moves down the block. You're really fundamentally not changing the larger system-wide issue. So what we did was develop this corridor analysis, which is on the right, and through a really pretty simple spatial analysis, we're able to identify 5% of street miles in our city that accounted for over 50% of severe and fatal injuries, as well as total pedestrian injuries. And what this did was really kind of transform the discussion about how can we geographically target our city resources to achieve what are daunting goals in terms of really preventing injury and death. And what it also did was, I think at an intersection level, people are more prone to kind of quibble about what did the driver do? What did the person walking do? Whereas at a corridor level, it really brings in other issues of, you know, what's happening along that corridor. You know, how is traffic moving along that corridor? Who lives on that corridor? It helps broaden the scope of what we're really considering as causal factors. So after we identified these corridors, we also drilled down into what we called high injury corridor case studies. And again, you'll see that we really rely on a GIS analysis for this work, and we developed what we also, a lot of this was just kind of developing new tools, so we called our pedestrian geodatabase, and really what that did was we had the spatial injury data, we linked it to data from the census, from our transportation departments, to really, again, paint a bigger picture of what's happening along the corridor. We also partnered with our transportation agencies to do collision diagramming, and we have a really awesome pedestrian environmental quality index at San Francisco where we can walk around and collect street level data, and we use that as well. And what this analysis then did in the context of a data subcommittee, so it wasn't just our health department, it's our health department with our transportation agencies, with the Department of Public Works and planning and community groups, was informed targeted recommendations. So we took a look at what was happening on this corridor, who lived on the corridor, what was happening with the injuries, and then made recommendations, including introducing traffic calming strategies, facilitating crossings for more vulnerable populations, et cetera. This is just an illustration of the pedestrian geodatabase. Again, as I mentioned, it combines environmental, socio-demographic, and injury data into one comprehensive database that really just no one in the city had the time, the resources, or the initiative to do. So now that we've created it, it's something that we can then field requests from the many different agencies that are designing our streets who want to, you know, they have a corridor, we can provide them this data. We set up a system so we can really crank it out pretty efficiently. So once we identified the high injury corridors, we also, as a part of the task force, we're partnering with other agencies who are then the implementers. So some examples of how this approach has informed the work of other agencies in our city include working with our police department, who can now focus traffic safety enforcement on those corridors. There are districts, so every district got a giant map of the corridors specific to their district, and the district captains are able to instruct the officers to, you know, on a routine basis, go along the corridors and look for behaviors we know that are killing people. And we've received a lot of feedback that essentially a lot of times police work can really be complaint driven. So having this type of analysis and the work of the task force behind them, they're able to be more responsive to the evidence regarding pedestrian injury. Also, with respect to engineering, again, through the work of the task force, our municipal transportation agency, historically their traffic program was a residential program. So again, very complaint driven, you know, who is really angry about people speeding through their streets, which is very important. But at the same time, they developed another arm of that program, which is arterial traffic calming, to again, take a look at these corridors and based on the evidence, address some of the most streets in our city where people are being killed. And they also developed a treatment toolkit for those corridors. So it's, again, it's very different from a residential street where you can throw in a traffic circle. Like, what can you do on a really high traffic corridor that's central to the movement of vehicles through our city? Also, as a part of this initiative, speed limits were reduced near schools, and some other really innovative traffic calming was piloted in our city. And with respect to planning, again, there was an existing collaborative effort that was happening between the Department of Public Health, our planning department, and our transportation agencies, looking to the future, prioritizing streets for comprehensive improvements. And this, the map that I had shared with the high injury corridors was able to very easily go into that process and be used as a part of a prioritization process for what streets are we going to improve to meet multiple objectives of different agencies. With respect to equity, that was another important goal of the executive directive, and we again did a very simple spatial analysis. These are supervisorial districts in San Francisco. We looked at severe and fatal injuries per mile in those districts, and just looked at the rates in the lowest district relative to the rates in the highest districts. The districts in red have equity ratios of over 3.5 times that of the lowest district. With based on additional analysis that isn't represented in this map, these are the same areas where we have concentrated vulnerable populations. And fundamentally, from an equity perspective, these are the communities where we have the most walking, the most sustainable behaviors that our city is promoting. So fundamentally, these are the communities where we also need to invest resources to make sure they're not disproportionately being injured as a result of that behavior. As I mentioned, this year has been an exciting year in terms of developing a larger roadmap for how we're going to move forward over the next 10 years to achieve our goals. This strategy will be released this fall, and will be there'll be a link on our website. In addition to the goals, that all of the agencies have been working on key actions that will be implemented to achieve the goals, clearly specifying the lead agency, by when, how much the costs are. The Department of Public Health is involved in really working on the outcomes that will be monitored to increase accountability to this plan throughout the years, as well as the strategy is laying out potential funding sources. But I think, as everyone in this room is probably aware, this plans like this are also really contingent on political will. So our community agencies have continued to be involved in this work, and some of our community transformation grant funding for San Francisco is going to support their continued efforts and collaboration to ensure that this happens. So with respect to where we're going in the future, now that this seed has been planted, we're really just working to help institutionalize this within the Environmental Health Department, continuing to really liaison with other agencies to be at the table with respect to data that other agencies have not historically had the resources to access and implement, and also really just looking for funding to further institutionalize these activities. So thank you very much, everyone.
Yeah, so what do you want to, should we all just, yeah. We'll all just come up here. Do you want to moderate the questions?
Sure.
Just a couple things just to mention. Our website is sfphes.org. It lays out how we've kind of structured the public communication on the project. I think it's interesting because we structure it in terms of high-level determinants of health, not like air pollution, noise, open space, planning, transportation, food, and that might be interesting to you. And you may want to friend us on Facebook. And it's Health Plus Environment. Yes? Yes? Yeah. And so check us out on Facebook, all that. So.
Okay.
I think that was the water one, and that was June.
It was, yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was actually, we administered it through the teachers. So there was no incentive, but I think the teachers either sent them home or had them sit there and do them in the classroom. And so that, I mean, that was quite a good number that got returned to us. So.
Actually, we actually partner with the school health program. So they had nutrition educators at these schools, and they administered it as part of just their curricula with the children.
Well, the truth is that I asked Tom Amiano's aide, Brad Benson, to write a letter to Mitch Katz to ask us to do the health impact assessment. And I think that once they understood it, they all supported the idea, and it moved forward. In San Francisco, the law was heading towards some kind of passage. The wage itself was being was debated, but it was there. And I think we don't have any pretense that we influenced the debate, but we taught ourselves something. We taught ourselves that we could get in. We could do a rigorous public health analysis of an employment policy. We also taught something. We sent a message out there to the world, and we sent a message out there to labor groups that public health could be a supportive partner on labor issues. And I think that really set the stage, and one thing led to another, more partnerships, more analysis, getting the message out. We can do this analysis. We can make a substantive scientific contribution, and labor groups, we are a shared, we're an ally. So Tom Amiano is an assembly member in the California Assembly right now, and he was a former city legislator. So we have a board of supervisors because it's a city and a county. Brad Benson was his aide. Mitch Katz was the director of health of the San Francisco Health Department from 1997 to 2010. And I think just that, I mean, a couple of other, I mean, how do we do all of this? We've gotten a little bit of external resources for some projects, but 90% of this work has been internal city funding. And it's been a reprioritization of the work efforts. It's been hiring people with social justice commitments and values to bring that into their work. So it's it hasn't been new resources. It's been a tremendous amount of allowing people to be creative, take risks, work autonomously, working in teams. So Environment Fest is a team. Cindy is our budget officer for environmental health, and she's a major player in the Fest team. So everyone may have different roles, but we come together sort of and work together with our hundreds of partners.
Could you comment a little bit about sort of the paradigm shift that this seems to represent? Lindsay was at our bike tour on Sunday, and the first thing she said was equity. And it seems like you're on the cusp of this as being, you know, important values which get at things. You're at public health, not driving the bus, but being on the bus. You're at incomplete science versus perfect science. It seems to me like there's a whole bunch of different made on some of those things.
Well, you're doing a great job of summarizing it.
I'm in awe.
I think science in the service of human needs and public policy of democracy. As I think I said yesterday, I mean, I think one thing that's really core is to all of that is that the health is achieved if you have an educated, inclusive, informed democracy that's responsive and works. So all of those, whether it's accountability, putting the health impact assessment information out there into the public space, supporting the enforcement of the law, is really about making democratic, informed, inclusive democratic governance work. And so that's the overarching, and it isn't about our profession. It isn't about that we create some new cool tool or analysis. It's about making that work.
I just want to add a quick anecdote. So Rajiv mentioned that I started work with the health department because I took his class my last semester of public health school, and it was a health impact assessment class, and he had us take like the little bit of research that we had done on this project. It was a land use project in Oakland, and go and testify at city council. And I was like, you want us to do what? Like, I don't know that I'm the expert on this. How am I supposed to go testify in front of city council? Like, and his emphasis was like, if you have the information, it should be informing decision making. If you have that information about how the lack of community participation is affecting the outcome of this project, that needs to be part of the discussion. And it's okay if it's not perfect. I was so appreciative of that being a really important piece of like the work that we're doing. And I think we do the best we can to have really integrative, is that a word? Science, but it's with, like you've been saying, to make sure that it's informing decision making, so we're making healthy decisions.
And when Megan did that, participated in that health impact assessment, the other students picked a traditional topic. One did air, one did noise, one did sort of housing, one did green space, and Megan did the impacts of the project on democratic governance. And so that was her chapter, and it was still probably the only chapter on this. And
don't do that.
Yeah. But and just for the record, it was an option to go and testify, and it was unanimous that the students all wanted
to
go. Charlie
encouraged.
Rajiv reminded me that we are envious of Chicago's pedestrian plan and their ambitious goals, and also their photo enforcement for speed. But he also
has a lot of those
tickets. It's not as popular.
Yeah. I actually want to say something about that because I mean, in the case of Tom Amiano, I mean, certainly I had a boss, Mitch Katz, that created a lot of freedom and autonomy, you know, in our work. He wasn't a public health guy. He was focused on health care and having a delivery system that provided equitable care for everyone. But he let everyone else be creative. We didn't actually have high level political support that I think you may be inferring. Tom is certainly Amiano was a progressive supervisor, but he actually didn't quite understand the results of the health impact assessment. His question to me was, how does this affect health care costs? And so it's just to take a step, and then in the next decade, he went off to the state, and there was work on land use planning. We actually had political opposition. We had the mayor and the mayor's staff very concerned about the meaning of our work for land use planning. I mean, ultimately, and it was quite oppositional for a time, but we survived, and we went ahead for another political reason, not political leadership from elected officials, not political leadership from department heads, but political leadership from grassroots organizations. We built a constituency and an alliance with grassroots organizations that kept us standing and moving ahead. We served those organizations, and that kept us moving ahead. And I don't know what people on the top think of this. And changes are happening now in San Francisco government, not that are not negative, but they're basically the message is, you know what, we need to get back to basics of filling potholes and doing the basics. We don't have room for the creativity, innovation, risk-taking, and leadership. And we're not. I think we're going to be investing a lot less in it, unfortunately.
Just from the sort of staff type of level responding, a couple of things I wanted to just inject, which first of all, Reggie has a very thick skin and absorbs a lot of the sort of external challenges, and I feel like we at the staff level are able then to sort of forge ahead even in the face of this sort of external political opposition. And then the other thing to remember is that perhaps on the local level, there's always, you know, an overall progressive feel to San Francisco. But the work that Rajiv started, you know, back in the late 90s, that was a very different, national political climate than the one that we're in today. And so all that work was going on, even in a kind of a perhaps less supportive environment. And I think for me, the message is that at the health department level, we can forge ahead, but you do have to have a thick skin, and it really does help to have a leader who has a super thick skin.
The politics is such an important point. I need to just mention something else. Things got oppositional. I mean, we learned how to work and navigate opposition and help. I mean, ultimately, we found ways to help lots of people's interests. And whether it was reducing Paula's work in removing competitive foods in San Francisco school districts and increasing their participation in revenues. I mean, the solutions that we came to and were able to help move forward were win-win-win so much, and they were equity solutions, it was pretty hard ultimately to say, I'm not for this. And so there's ways to do it. It's not easy, but if you understand the landscape, you build from sort of, respond to community needs, you work with a lot of partners, you try to find those win-wins, you can do it. And if public health does things, I think that, let's, anyone from New York City? Okay. Mm-hmm. So New York City did this soda thing recently, and just I want to, because I think it was a top-down thing on a very important issue. Let's not debate the approach, but they did it, and they have a very unusual health authority. They have a mayor appointing a health commissioner, a health commission, and the health commission having the same power as the city council to enact laws under whoever wrote the New York Constitution must have just ignored separation of powers for a moment there. And I think that very, very, that's a lot of power to wield, but if it's wielded, I don't know why I'm going here, but if it's not wielded carefully, that power is going to get taken away. And I think some of the reactions to that are seeing that. But if that power could be used to support community needs, I think it could be a tremendous power.
Somebody else.
Other questions?
job.
Well, I have my first before I answer your question. I did want to point out the reason that Paula knew the answer to the question about schools is that Paula was actually extremely instrumental, and I want to acknowledge her really more than participation, but involvement in that schools project. I was on secondary. But in answer to your question, we're starting to try to kind of take our own initiative because we've relied on website, like sort of the standard DPH website to get out our information, but we're trying now with Lindsay's help to be more modern about our approach and using social media and trying to think about different ways of reaching out that way. You know, that is sort of a technological answer to your question, but that is how, I mean, we've always, I think, been pretty effective at getting the word out in a more traditional way as far as using grassroots and typical, communication, interpersonal communication. But now, in today's world, that is archaic. and we have realized that we need to have the more modern presence to do that, so we're working on it.
Yeah, and I think communication was a neglected issue. We played a very kind of supportive role in a lot of struggles. A lot of our work, it's not like, okay, it's these people doing this work, but the relevant health facts have gotten out there because through the partners, not through us. So working with hundreds of partners or other agencies, and the message, the substantive message gets out there. The messenger doesn't necessarily get out there that we were the messenger, and we're trying to do a little bit more spotlighting on the messenger. Finally.
Engage residents, sitting on task forces or being appointed to different bodies that residents serve on as kind of the health representatives. So I like with the public utilities commission, transportation agencies, planning departments, etc. So I think it's public health having a face on in those bodies that they don't traditionally have.
I also wanted to add that, like, as we're partnering with our community members, that they're also helping with dissemination. So, like, as we partner with the Chinese Progressive Association, they help translate certain things into Chinese. With some of the labor organizations, they translate into Spanish and, like, help disseminate it out that way. And so the dissemination sort of depends on, like, who the partners and, like, who the target audience is. But there's many different ways that we're disseminating information.
Anyone else? All right. Well, thank you everyone so much for coming.